Okay, now, just to bring us up to speed, Jacob ran away from home. Just wait. I'll tell you, I promise. Jacob ran away from home. Now, who can tell me why he ran away from home? To save his life. His mother, Rebekah, heard his brother Esau and what he intended to do. But there's another reason he left. And on page 109 in your notes, before he leaves, Isaac speaks to Jacob. And so let's read just verses 1 to 9. And this is the real... God, of course, is using human circumstances, but let's look at the real, what's really going on here. Because all these human events that are taking place, God has a purpose, and that purpose cannot be thwarted. So we're in chapter 28, page 109 in your book, and chapter 28 in the scriptures. And we'll see from God's point of view why he has, amidst all this stuff that's going on, he has a reason for, and Isaac as well has a reason for Jacob going where he's going. So let's read verses 1 to 9 first in Genesis 28. So Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and from there take yourself a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother." Laban was his uncle. "May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply, that you may become a company of peoples. May he also give you the blessing of Abraham." "To you and your descendants with you, that you may possess the land of your sojournings, and which God gave to Abraham." Now notice something. See in verse, we'll see this in the notes, but I want to point it out. See verse 3. God bless, may he bless you. Remember he said to Abraham, "I will bless you. Make you fruitful and multiply." Remember he said that to Abraham. "Give you the blessings of Abraham, to you and your descendants with you, that you may possess the land of your sojournings." Said that to Abraham, which God gave to Abraham. So what's happening here is Isaac is sending Jacob away to get a wife. But he's doing it in a way that, I mean, we just mentioned the major provisions of the Abrahamic covenant. And so from Jacob's point of view, from Isaac's point of view, he wants to keep the line of the seed pure because he wants to protect the promises that God made to Abraham and to him as well. So that's really the bigger picture here of what's going on. "Then Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Paddan Aram to Laban, son of Bethuel the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau." This is all within the family. Now Esau, who was not the brightest guy in the world, but I don't think he had a bad heart. I just think he wasn't... "Now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take himself a wife from there." Notice, not from Canaan, but from his father's, from his family. "And that when he blessed him, he charged him, saying, 'You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan.' And that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and had gone to Paddan Aram. So Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan displeased his father Isaac, and Esau went to Ishmael and married, beside the wives he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebaioth. Okay? So we'll have to talk about what Esau's, you know, what he's doing and why and what's going on there. But the important thing is that now Jacob is now going to be going to Paddan Aram to find for himself, or really for God to provide him a wife, so that the line of promise and blessing and the seed can be carried on. Anybody else remember something similar to this happening? Somebody going, remember Eliezer made a vow to Abraham and he went there, and basically speaking, he found a wife there for Isaac, and the family okayed it, and the wife, Rachel okayed it, and they went back, and so Isaac married within the, you know, he kept the bloodline pure that way, okay? Well, the same thing's happening here, essentially. Isaac wants Jacob to marry so that they can be perpetuated, but he doesn't want him to marry a woman from where they live. Because if he does that, and we'll see in more detail what happens here, if he does that, the line of blessing or the covenant line with the line of the seed, you know, all of those describe this, will become, it'll, the best word I can come up with right now is polluted. And I don't really like that word. There's probably better words I could use. Impure, you know, it'll go off the track or something, but it, you know, the line of the seed will not go in exactly the direction that God planned it to go. So, going to the notes, like Abraham before him, Isaac did not want his son Jacob to go to Canaan or to marry a Canaanite woman. And again, the reason we see that is because there's a line now, a line of blessing. And the line of blessing, if he marries a Canaanite woman, that jeopardizes the line of blessing. Because there can always be a tendency for a wife to influence her husband, and the next thing you know, Jacob becomes like the Canaanites. And the Abrahamic covenant goes out the window. Of course, God's not going to let that happen. But he works through people. So, A, now watch what would happen here. In the culture of the Canaanites, if a person married someone who was not in his clan, he lost his cultural identity. And that's what would happen if Jacob had married someone from Canaan, a woman from Canaan. He would, in all likelihood, and certainly if not him, his posterity, would lose their cultural identity. And then the line of the seed would have nowhere to go anymore. The Canaanites were a mixed breed because of their habit of marrying someone not of their clan. You know, in the ancient world, there were what we're calling clans now, or tribes. And it's just like, imagine if there's an American Indian tribe called the Sioux. The Sioux Indians were a tribe. They lived together as a tribe, and they married with another Sioux Indian. But imagine Sioux Indians started going and marrying Indians from other tribes. And this tribe, eventually, the Sioux Indians would lose their cultural identity. And it's the same thing that could happen here. But more importantly is that there's the covenant promises that God made that have to be carried through this line. So it's essential that the line remain pure. Okay? Also, if Jacob married a Canaanite woman, the line of the promised seed would become impure. I like that word better than polluted. Impure, and the blessings God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would become jeopardized. Can you see that? You know what it's like? It's kind of simple. There's a tendency. This doesn't always happen in our day. In our day, things change a little bit. But there has always been a tendency for Jewish people to marry Jewish people. That's a custom. Now, in our modern society, those things are not as important to people as they were in times past. But suppose a Jewish young man marries a woman who is a non-Jewish Catholic. I have seen situations where the young man converted to Catholicism, and they raised their children in the Catholic Church. Now, the purpose of what I'm saying is not at all to put down the Catholic Church. That's not the point that I'm making. The point that I'm making is, if you marry outside of your clan, your tribe, your family, whatever it is, your heritage, and especially if your people make a habit of doing that, then what happens is that your tribe or family or whatever you want to call it becomes assimilated, and it loses its cultural identity. And in this particular case, God could not allow that to happen because the cultural identity of the Jewish people was absolutely essential for two reasons. Well, for a number of reasons, but think about it. First of all, the Abrahamic covenant was promised to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jacob and their descendants. If Jacob went and married and lost his cultural identity, then where his descendants are not going to, you know, eventually, generation two, three, the promises are going to get lost to the people. And so you can see where, from God's point of view, it's important to keep the line pure. It's important to keep the line pure, okay? Now, Roman numeral 3, ironically, the unchosen son of Isaac, right, married into the unchosen line of Ishmael. So you can see, whatever Esau's motives were, they were not in accordance with God's plan. I mean, imagine if Jacob had married into the unchosen line of Ishmael. The cultural identity that was coming forth from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would be lost. And then what would happen to God's promises to Abraham? Yes?
There were evidently also some Canaanite.
Wait, say again? Well, yeah, that too.
The last line of chapter 27, Rebecca said to Isaac, I am weary of my life before the daughters of heaven. If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of heaven, like these from the daughters of the land, what is my life?
Yeah, but she had an ulterior motive, don't forget.
I know, it was...
Yeah, but the reason she said... I know, I understand, and I'm not disputing what you're saying. But the thing that really motivated her to do that was she wanted to get Jacob safely away from Esau.
And there must have been, Esau must have had some positive characteristics.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think Esau was just a little mixed up.
She didn't want to lose him. She said to Jacob, why should I lose both of you right now? You go.
Well, I don't know. I'd have to look at that if he's talking about Jacob and Esau or Jacob and Isaac, because Isaac was an old man. But the point here, there's a lot of directions we can take this. The point is the preservation of the line of blessing. And so it may well be true that what you're saying is accurate. I'm not disputing that at all. But her primary motive was to get Jacob away and have him be safe, because she knew what Esau's intention was. Okay, so I'm not disputing what you're saying. What you're saying... She wasn't really lying. She was manipulating. You know, I'm sure she had no love for these daughters of
Jacob. She could have hired somebody to kill Esau than Jacob herself.
Well, that's true, but I don't think we, you know, I don't think I don't think we want to speculate her into a murderess. Okay, now verses 10 to 22. But basically, we can see what's happening here. And again, I'm not at all disputing what you're saying. Sometimes a person can tell the truth, but they tell the truth with what we call an ulterior motive. So what she's saying is true. She may have said that even if the Jacob and Esau problem had never arisen. We don't know. But we do know that she heard that Esau was going to murder Jacob, and Jacob was her favorite, so she wanted to get him out of there, and so she comes to Isaac, who has to give the final okay, and says what she says. So she was using the truth to manipulate. Okay, now, verses 10 to 22. Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran. He came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had set. Now this is something, when I see Jacob, I've got to ask him a question, and it always bothers me. Now read this, if you will. He came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had set, and he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place and went to sleep. I'm going to say, Jacob, how in the world did you use a stone for a pillow? I mean, imagine you go to Nordstrom's or Macy's, and you go to the linen section, and in one quarter, there's a big pile of stones. And you say, that one looks nice, and you carry it to your car, put it down, and you put your head on it and try to go to sleep. I don't see how you could do that. Yes. Oh, well, the ground doesn't give me any problem. When I was a Boy Scout, yeah, but a stone. When I was a Boy Scout, they taught us how to, when I was a Boy Scout, we used to travel, and when we would make camp, what we used to do is sleep on the ground. We had sleeping bags. You're familiar with them? And what we used to do is there's a way that you can dig into the ground. Not very deep, but if you do it the right way with the little valleys and the little hill, if you do it just right, your body will fit right in there. And what I used for a pillow was, what, you ever familiar with an air pillow? And I used to use an air pillow. So, but I just got to say to Jacob, how in the world did you fall asleep with your head on a rock? Maybe you had a hard head, I don't know. But anyway, continuing on, so he's lying down with his head on the rock. He had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. Now, first, anybody, does that tickle your memory a little bit and remember another place in the scriptures that might relate to this? Well, how about in John? Turn to the book of John for just a minute. Then we'll come back here and spend some time with this, because this is an important verse. So we go to John chapter 1. Now, watch what it says. Just listen to me for a minute, and then we'll do our thing in John chapter 1. He had a dream, and behold, the ladder was set on earth with its top reaching to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. Now, in John 1, let's go to verse 47. Ready? John 1, verse 47. Yeshua, Jesus, found Nathanael coming to him. Actually, we should start at 45 so we can pick up the flow better. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law And also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. Nathanael said to them, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? It was just small, you know, doesn't come like Washington, D.C., or Jerusalem, or Moscow, with Nazareth. But anyway, Jesus, well, Nathanael said to them, can anything come out of Nazareth? Philip said to him, come and see. Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said of him, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit. So they had never met. So it's reasonable for Nathanael to say to him, how do you know me? You know, we've never met, to say such a thing. And then Jesus answered and said to him, before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. Now, in the Old Testament, that expression, being under the fig tree, quite often when the author, the prophet, is writing about the millennium, the time of peace, each man will be under his tree and dwell safely. And I think it was pretty much a custom for men in those days to go outside and have their special tree, and they would sit in the shade during the day and meditate and pray. So here Jesus said to him, Nathanael said to him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God, you are the King of Israel. Okay, so I guess a question I want to ask ask Nathanael is, what were you doing under the tree? Maybe he was praying that the Lord would reveal his Messiah to him. Who knows? But whatever he was doing under that tree, the fact that Yeshua even knew that he was under that tree, that's evidence of his omnipresence and of his omniscience, right? But watch what Jesus says now. When Nathanael realizes who Jesus is, he says, Rabbi, you are the Son of God, you are the King of Israel. Now watch this response. Jesus answered and said to him, because I said to you that I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these. Now watch the response. And he said to him, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. You see that? Now we go back to Genesis, the chapter we're reading. He had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. See that? And the thing here, what's happening here is there's two things that are happening here, two very important things. First of all, so far as Jacob is concerned, this was a way that God was saying to Jacob, you're going to be out of the land now. You're going to go and seek a wife and come back. I will be with you. I will always be present. But more importantly than that, well, not more importantly, but also is the fact that that ladder is a type of the Messiah. Because in Genesis it says that there was a ladder and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it, heaven. And then Yeshua said, you shall see the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. So the ladder is it, we've talked about types and anti-types, haven't we? The ladder, and basically speaking, the application for believers is, and it's the same as the application for Jacob, no matter where we go, God is with us. Taking that back a step, we cannot go anywhere but that God is not there. If we have to leave our homeland, if God calls us to another place, God will always be there for us. There's no such thing as a believer not having God present in his life or her life. And, you know, to these people, for Jacob to leave the promised land, I could see why he would be nervous about that. For example, what if all of a sudden you got a call from God to go to Iran as a missionary? But if the call's from God, then the ladder extends from heaven down to where you are, even in Iran. And he's there. Okay? So, and behold, the Lord stood above it and said, now listen to what the Lord says. I am the Lord, now this is significant, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Now here's the interesting thing. The ladder represents who? Yeshua, Jesus, right? Now, who's speaking here to Jacob? Yeshua. And one of the things that some people have difficulty with, there's only one God. We've got to remember that. There's one God, but there's three persons in the Godhead. Separate identities, same essence, right? In the Old Testament, when God reveals himself to a prophet in a dream, in a vision, or even Moses face to face, or the burning bush, or the pile, or the column of smoke and fire in the wilderness, those manifestations of God are always manifestations of the second person of the triunity of God. To say it simply, Jesus, and again, I have to preface this so we don't misunderstand, there's one God. But of the three persons of the Godhead, Jesus is that person who is the God of the Old Testament. Now, it's hard for me to word this just the way I would like to, because I don't want to make it seem as though he's a different God than the Father or the Son. He's not. But he's the person of the Godhead who is the representative God revealing himself in the Old Testament. Yes?
I'm thinking, while Jesus being the ladder, when it says Jehovah speaks from above, isn't that the tetragram or whatever?
No, we have to be careful. We've got to remember something. We don't want to take something like this too far. We know what we can see clearly, but you want to be careful not to strain the image. That's what they call that. This is... Well, Jesus is Jehovah, and so is the Holy Spirit, and so is the Father. They're all God. So, you know, any name of God can be applied to any one of the three persons of the triunity of the Godhead. Now, I guess there may be some exceptions to that, because Son of God is only applied to Yeshua, right? And the angel of the Lord is only applied to Yeshua. So there's always exceptions to the rule. But basically speaking, when you have imagery like this, you want to take what is certain from that image and try not to strain it. That's what they used to do back a few centuries ago. They would take a passage like this and come up with 15, 20 symbols that they got out of it. And you got to be careful with that. You got to be careful when you're working with metaphor and stuff like that. The most important thing to see here is, number one, God was with Jacob even when he was not in the land. And number two, well, actually three things. The Jewish people who were in the wilderness would read this and realize God is with us, just as he was with Jacob. That's the real lesson for the Jewish people to whom it was originally written. And now we as believers can say, God is with us. God is with us. And no matter where we go, he will be with us. Okay? Okay, let's take our first break. there's another important implication from what we were speaking about before the break, and that is this. We've seen that there's this ladder going from heaven to earth, right? And the ladder is a type, and the type means something like a foreshadow of Yeshua. There's one ladder. And when you take John 1 and combine it with Genesis 28, one of the things we conclude is that Jesus is, how should I put this well? Jesus is the only way, but a sure way, to get to heaven. He's the ladder. Okay? Okay. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, verse 14. And you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in your descendants, now that word that's translated descendants there, again, is the word seed. Now the translators are using the plural there, right? And remember what we said, the Hebrew word that's translated seed is a word that can be in the singular or the plural depending upon the context. Okay? But that doesn't really create a great problem with us because we know that in the singular, when it says if we make the statement in Abraham's seed singular, all the nations of the world shall be blessed, we know that's the Messiah, the end of the line of the seed, right? But if we take it in the plural, then what God would be saying is, through the Jewish people, all the nations of the world will be blessed. And what does Paul say in Romans? How did we get the scriptures? Through the Jewish people. And that's, Paul makes a big point of that when he's somewhat defending the purpose and the value of the Jewish people. Okay? And then he says to him in verse 15, "Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised to you." Now, picture yourself, for example, and I walk up to you and I say to you, "God wants you to go to Chicago." Should you just up and go because I said so? Obviously not. Who am I? What do I know about your life? But if you were one day in your room, let's say reading the Bible, and all of a sudden there stood before your bed a man whose garments were so white, more pure white than any launderer on earth can lighten them, and his face was glowing like the sun, and he said, "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Go to Chicago and I will be with you." You can take that to the bank. See the difference. When God says, "I will be with you," that's as true as 1 + 1 = 2, because God doesn't change. So here he says, "I will not leave you until I have done what I've promised you." And we see all the promises he's making to him. So Jacob can confidently resume his journey and he doesn't have to worry about, you know, these were dangerous places back then. There were tribes that would roam the countryside looking for smaller tribes and families and individuals to rob them and possibly kill them. This was not the most peaceful place on earth at that time. But God said he would be with him. He was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. And this is the gate of heaven." So Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on its top. Now, we'll discuss that in the notes a little bit. Let me explain what's happening. He's not building an altar here. The translators wisely use the word pillar instead of using the word altar. This is not an altar. But when you stack rocks up like that at a place, it indicates that that is a place where God has been seen. And pouring oil on it, remember how they would pour oil on the king when he became king, or they would pour oil on the priest when he was ready to do his priestly duties? The oil sanctifies and sets apart. That's the purpose of the oil. And so this place was sanctified and set apart. And in those days and in that culture, people would know where these places were. And so as they were traveling, they would go to these places where God had been seen, and they would use it as a prayer place. So that's what he did. Now in verse 19, he called the name of that place Bethel. And Bethel, remember when he said this is the house of God? That's what Bethel means. Bethel means the house of God. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. Then Jacob made a vow. Here's Jacob's response, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and give me the food and garments to give me food to eat and garments to wear, I will return to my father's house in safety. Then the Lord will be my God. This stone, which I set up as a pillar, will be God's house, and all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. Now that tenth, that's a tithe, is the word that's often used there. We're going to be talking about tithes, but I don't think we'll get to it today. We may or we may not. But I'm going to have to check something out. There's something very interesting. In the Greek language, you know the word if? In the English language, the word if always means maybe it will, maybe it won't, right? Or if I get a good grade on the test, then I'll get to go to the college I want to, and maybe I will, maybe I won't. It's iffy. It's if. Now, the Greek language is very interesting. In the Greek language, there's an if that means just what we've described. There's also a Greek word, if, and it is so. And there's a Greek word, if, and it is not so. For example, remember when the Lord said, if it were possible, remove this from, you know, when he was praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, the if he used there is if, and it's not so. He knew that what he had to do was going to come to pass. I don't know whether or not the Hebrew worked the same way, and I'm going to have to look into that. Because this vow that Jacob's making, he uses the word if, but he's given an assurance by God. And I don't think that this if is a wavering in his faith. I think he's just responding in his own words to what God has said and acknowledging God's will for his life. Okay? And he says, then the Lord will be my God, and then he set up the pillar there. Okay, let's go back to the notes. Okay, we're on page 109 at the bottom of the page. The promises of the covenant are confirmed at Bethel. You see what's happening here? The promises that God originally made to Abraham and were passed on to Isaac are now being passed on and confirmed to Jacob. Okay? Jacob followed his parents' advice and began his journey to... the word his shouldn't be there. Paddan Aram. His destination was his uncle Laban's house in Haran. Now we're going to be moving to what a lot of scholars call the Laban chapters. This is a whole. There's a few chapters here that stress the relationship Jacob has with Laban, and it's very interesting what happens here. Jacob, stopping for the night on his way to his uncle Laban's house at Haran in Paddan Aram, dreamed of angels on a stairway to heaven. The point of the story is that wherever Jacob went, God was with him. This was symbolized by the ladder. Explained in words by God, and recognized in faith by Jacob. Now, let me read something for you. You know how sometimes in the Bible, great theological truths can be put into beautiful poetry like David does? You can just sit and listen or turn. I'm going to be reading something to you, and we'll discuss it briefly. But remember what has just happened. God has promised Jacob a number of things, and the most immediate thing that he promised Jacob is he would be with him. His hand of protection would be upon him. Now, I'm going to take just a couple minutes and read a psalm, and I want you to listen to this psalm. And I want you to think of this psalm in terms of your own life. It's Psalm 139. O Lord, and by the way, this is a psalm of David, and it's a song, because you see where it says, for the choir director? And did I tell you before, that little, where it says, for the choir director, Psalm of David, that's part of the inspired text. If there's something above that, like in my Bible, it says, God's omnipresence and omniscience in italics, that's the translators put that in there. But in the Psalms, when there's a little heading before the Psalm, that's part of the inspired text. Now listen, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit up and when I rise up, sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thoughts from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down, and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, Lord, you know it all. Anybody ever hear of openness theology, which teaches God does not know the future acts of moral beings? It's not biblical. There are born-again scholars teaching that it is, because they want to try and reconcile sovereignty and free will. But that makes it pretty clear. He knows what you want to say before you do. You have enclosed me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it. And now, thousands of years later, we know this is true, but we can't understand it either. The wonderful power of God. Now, here's where it starts to relate to what we're looking at in Genesis. Where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me, and your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to you, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. You can see the folly of trying to hide from God. You know, you're going to do something wrong, and you just do it in such a way that no one knows. But God is there when you're doing it. You can't escape God. For you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. That's something for those who believe that abortion is just fine. You're destroying God's work. You're destroying. When a woman becomes pregnant and that egg starts to divide, you know how it does? And then as it divides, it starts to look like a little teeny thing that looks somewhat human, and then it winds up, of course, 9 months later being a baby. It's God forming that child in the womb. And so I disagree with those who say life begins at the 9th month. It's arbitrary, you know. And the fact of the matter is, in medical science, they used to believe life began when you were born. That's what they believed. And the more we have come to learn about this, the earlier and earlier and earlier they're realizing life starts. And we as believers know it starts at conception. So therefore, an abortion is the taking of a life. Now, I know that the abortion people would not accept that, but the abortion people who say life doesn't begin until the 3rd trimester or whatever, they're saying that only because they have to. They have no basis for it. They have no scientific basis for it. They're saying it because they have to. But modern science has shown us that life begins far earlier than it was once believed. Okay. For you have formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it quite well. How someone can go through 4 years of medical school and be an atheist is something I do not understand. The human body is so unbelievably wonderful. And I'll tell you, here's something interesting. There was a woman, let me tell you something interesting. There was a woman once who gave birth to a child, and the child was, there's something wrong with the child, disabled in some way. I'm not sure what the disability is. Then she got pregnant again and gave birth to another child. And the same thing, the child was malformed or in some way incapacitated. Make a long story short, she had like 5 or 6 children. I think it was 6. And all 6 of her children, unfortunately, were born with some kind of disability that would cause them to have to be cared for probably their whole life. Now she gets pregnant again. And all of her friends and neighbors and relatives are saying to her, you've got to end this pregnancy. Look what you're going to bring another malformed baby into the world. And she just didn't believe in abortion. A life is a life. Who are we to make quality of life decisions? So she decided to bring this baby inside her to term, and she gave birth to Beethoven. Beethoven. So abortions, I mean, there are places where people want a boy and they get a girl, you know, and when they realize it's a girl, they abort it. There's places where they use the morning pill is an abortion. If 2 people have sexual relationships and the woman does conceive, the next morning, all that's really in her belly at that time is just a cell that's ready to start dividing. And the morning after pill ends that. But the instant that sperm enters the cell, that's when life starts. Okay? My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Depths of the earth is a metaphor for a safe place. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance. And listen to this one. And I'd like to challenge the openest theologians with this. And in your book were written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. He knows where each one of us is going to be 1 month from now and what we will be doing. We don't. And as a matter of fact, God knows all things actual and possible. What that means is if I have to make a decision and there's three alternatives open to me, God knows what will result from each one of those three alternatives, and he knows which one I'm going to choose, and he knows the results of that alternative. But so he knows the result of an actual behavior on my part, how it will end up. And he knows if I had chosen this way or this way or this way or this way, exactly where that would have gone. So, and that's why it's so important to have God leading us. When we come to those forks in the road, it's nice to have God standing there and pointing down the way that you should go. And of course, he does that through his word. That's true. That's true. They have been learning that women who have abortions are affected by it, regardless of the reason. It has a very detrimental effect on women that the abortion people don't want to even talk about. But women who have an abortion, it's not a good thing for that woman. Now, I don't want to close the door completely. If a doctor was 100% certain that this pregnancy is going to end in the death of both the mother and the child, and there was no doubt about it, then I can understand under that, what I just described, I could be sympathetic towards an abortion, because the choice is have them both die or have only one die. But that's pretty narrow. That's pretty narrow. Okay. Okay, thank you. Okay, let's continue in the psalm. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. And that's somewhat of a hyperbole, but, you know, the fact of the matter is, God thinks about us more than we think about him. He does. He's thinking about you all the time. Every moment of your life, he's thinking about you. While you're asleep, he's thinking about you. He knows your hurts, he knows your joys, he knows everything. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. So you can be confident when you go to sleep at night, God is with you. And when you wake up the next morning, you can be confident that he will still be there with you. Okay, I will never leave you, nor will I ever forsake you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed, for they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the utmost hatred. They have become my enemies. And look at the prayer he prays at the end of this. And this, let me tell you something, this is a risky prayer. Don't pray this prayer unless you're really serious about what you're doing, because God will answer it. Listen to this. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. And see if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. That's a risky prayer. Now, it's really not a risky prayer, but what I'm saying is if you sincerely pray that to God, he is going to reveal things that you don't want to see in yourself. And in him leading you in the right path, there may be some pain that's involved. So, but it is when I say it's a risky prayer, it's also, I would say, in the long run, a very secure prayer. Because if God's doing that in our lives, then we can be sure that he is with us. It's a sign that he's with us. Okay, I just wanted to look at that verse. And again, that verse applied to David, but it also applied to Jacob, and it applies to every one of us. Okay. Continuing on. God reiterated to Jacob the covenant made with Abraham and Isaac, promising him the land. Wait, where was I? Descendants as numerous as the dust and universal blessing through him. Those are the major provisions of the Abrahamic covenant. God also promised to protect and be with Jacob while he was out of the land and to see that he returned. Jacob's worshipful response included having fear before God, erecting a memorial stone, that altar that we talked about. I'm sorry, that pillar we talked about. It was not an altar. They would not sacrifice on it. Consecrating the stone by anointing it with oil. We discussed that. Naming the place Bethel, which means house of God, to commemorate the event. Making a vow in which for the first time is faith in the Lord will be my God, and promising to tithe. We can see there's a change starting to take place in Jacob's character, you know? And that's what happens when you have an encounter with the living God. All of these things enhance the central idea of God's protective presence. Several motifs pertaining to later Israelite customs are embellished here in Jacob. The most notable is the memorial at Bethel. Later, the conquering Israelites would reckon this a holy place where God could be seen. So you can see that the original readers of this were affected by it, and that was the idea, but it applies to us as well. Another motif here is tithing. To give a tithe was to acknowledge that everything we have is from God. Now, here's what we're going to do. I want to talk a little bit about tithing since it's mentioned here, but I want to talk a lot about it. Of course, it's a very hotly debated and it can be a confusing doctrine. And there's some key scriptures I want to go over, but I want to do it at the beginning of next time, because it's not something I want to rush through. Another motif here is tithing, is with Abraham. Remember Abraham tithed to Melchizedek? So to give a tithe was to acknowledge that everything we have is from God. We're returning some of what he has given to us and showing and demonstrating our faith. Also, Jacob's vow is important in this event. He vowed that if God would protect him, provide for him, and return him to his homeland, then this place would become a major worship center for him. Moreover, standing stones also became important from this point on. These are different from altars. Memorials were set up to recall divine visitations so that others might learn about God when they ask, what did these stones mean? And that was the whole idea. Remember, God, Moses was writing to the Jewish people. And the Jewish people could go to Bethel and be where Jacob had been. And it was still a place of prayer with the stones still there. God's promise... God's promise to be with his people is a theme repeated throughout the scriptures. For example, God said to Isaac, "Do not be afraid, for I am with you." It applies to the Jewish people, it applies to us. The assurance of God's presence should, and about is the wrong word, should be become. It's a little typo. The assurance of God's presence should become in every believer the same response of worship and confidence it prompted. Actually, you know what word should be there? Not become, but prompt is better. That's probably the word I had in mind when I was writing it. Should prompt in every believer the same response of worship and confidence it prompted in Jacob. This is the message from the beginning. God's grace visits his people and promises them protection so that in turn... they might be a blessing to others. Got to get the word they in there. They in turn were to respond in faith, fearing him, worshiping him, offering to him, vowing to him, and making memorials for worshipers at such places. questions? Now remember, next time what we're going to do is talk a little bit about the tithe before we go on to the next chapter. I think it's important. Since it's mentioned here, I think it's important. We're meeting again on the 17th. Okay. Turn this off.